Well, after the 10 o'clock news tonight, Stephen Sutton takes us to Borneo to find out about a day in the jungle there. That's at 10:15. But now, Saturday Night Theatre.
We invite you to Christmas at Dingley Dell, which has been adapted from the Pickwick Papers and Christmas Stories of Charles Dickens by Constance Cox, with David March as Mr. Pickwick and Nigel Graham as our storyteller, Charles Dickens. Christmas at Dingley Dell.
On the 23rd of December in the year 1827, a day when the frost was binding the earth in its iron fetters and busily engaged in weaving its beautiful network upon the trees and hedges, Mr. Pickwick and his three friends, Mr. Tupman, Mr. Snodgrass and Mr. Winkle, together with Mr. Pickwick's manservant Sam Weller, set out upon a journey to Manor Farm, Dingley Dell, where they were to stay as guests of their friend, Mr. Wardle. Not only were they to enjoy the festivities of a good, old-fashioned Christmas, but there was also to be a wedding. That of Mr. Wardle's elder daughter, Isabella, to her childhood sweetheart, George Trundle.
Luggage all stowed away, Sam.
Safe and sound, sir.
Before we go, sir, just let me check with my way bill. 5 passengers to the Blue Boar Muggleton. Pickwick, Tupman, Snodgrass, Winkle and Weller. All correct, gentlemen?
Right, correct, coachman.
Coachman mounts to his box, and with a crack of the whip, a clatter of hooves and a rumble of wheels, the four friends are away on their journey. Soon the streets of London gave way to the broad and open country, and as Dingley Dell drew nearer, each Pickwickian became engaged upon his own thoughts. Mr. Pickwick's rubicund face beamed as he thought of the pleasures of friendship, and perhaps not a little of the joys of Mr. Wardle's bountiful table. Mr. Tupman was lost in recalling the charms of Miss Rachel Wardle, their host's unmarried sister, while Mr. Snodgrass was endeavouring to compose a poem that would do justice to the beauty of Miss Emily, Mr. Wardle's younger daughter. The sportsman of the party, Mr. Winkle, having no amorous attachment at present, divided his thoughts between the hopes of there being an unattached young lady among the guests at Dingley Dell, and the possibility of his performing prodigious feats of gamesmanship to delight and astound the company.
Here we are, gentlemen. Blue Boar Muggleton with a minute to spare. Watch the step as you get down. It may be slippery.
Yes, thank you. It was a splendid journey, coachman. Splendid. We have some luggage to collect from the booth, if you would tell my son.
Looking at it now, sir.
Up that, Winkle, you better check your luggage. Not grasp. Bless my soul if he isn't still sitting up on top. Snodgrass.
What? Oh, I beg your pardon, my dear friend. I was lost in my reverie.
Yes, well.
All present, sir? Pickwick, Tubman, Snodgrass,
yes,
Winkle,
yes,
and Weller?
Yes, we are all here, coachman. And a very happy Christmas to you.
Oh, much obliged, sir. And a very happy one to you,
thank
sir.
Thank you, coachman.
Oh, put those horses too, will you? We only have 5 minutes to stop.
There you are, sir. The luggage in the eatables, sir.
You did remember the codfish.
It ain't likely I'd forget that,
and
sir.
And the oysters.
Mr. Tupman's are sitting in one of the barrels now, what? Sir.
Oh, yes, I see. Tupman.
Yes, what is it?
Those are oysters. I do think it inappropriate.
Sorry, Pickwick.
As Mr. Pickwick was busily engaged in counting the barrels of oysters, he felt himself gently pulled by the skirts of his coat. Looking round, he discovered that the individual who resorted to this mode of catching his attention was none other than Mr. Wardle's favourite page, better known by the intriguing appellation of the Fat Boy.
Well, Miss Soul, if it isn't Joe.
That's right, sir.
Well, you look rosy enough, my young friend.
Oh, I've been asleep in front of the taproom fire, sir.
Ah.
Master sent me over with the shay cart to carry your baggage up to the house.
Oh, how very kind of him.
Oh, he'd have sent some saddle horses, but he thought you'd rather walk it, being a cold day.
Yes, yes, we would rather walk. Sam,
sir?
Help
Mr. Wardle's servant put these packages into the cart and then ride back with him.
We shall walk forward at once.
Having given this direction, Mr. Pickwick, Mr. Winkle and Mr. Tupman struck out across the footpath and walked briskly away. Mr. Snodgrass, however, lingered.
Joe?
Sir?
How is Miss Emily?
Oh, she were well enough when I seed her half an hour ago, sir.
Thank you, Joe, thank you. I'd like to shake you by the hand, if you don't mind.
Not a bit, sir. How do you do?
And here's half a crown for you, my boy. You're a good fellow.
Snodgrass, we are waiting.
Come in, Pickwick.
Come along.
During this exchange, Sam Weller, never having seen the fat boy before, had been looking at him with great astonishment. Now he began to stow the luggage rapidly away in the cart, while the fat boy stood quietly by and seemed to think it a very interesting sort of thing to see Mr. Weller working all by himself.
Oh, that's the baggage stowed. The barrels can go under our feet and we'll put the basket between us.
Is them eatables?
Well, they ain't coals, that's a sure thing. In you get, young Cropsy, if the springs will stand it.
I like seeding, I do.
Can't say as I'm surprised to hear it. You're a nice prize specimen of a boy, you are.
Thank you.
What are you doing when you're not eating?
Sleeping. But I like eating best. Can you drive?
Eh?
Drive.
I should rather think I can.
Take the reins.
What? I don't know the way.
Oh, it's straight on. Far as you can go. You can't miss it.
Hey, wake up, young 20-stone. You can't go to sleep just like that. Hey, stop that, will you? Well, that's cool, I must say, as the gentleman said when he fell down the well. Come on, wake up, young Dropsy.
But as young Dropsy showed no symptoms of returning animation, Sam Weller shrugged his shoulders, started the old horse with a jerk of the reins, and jogged steadily towards Dingley Dell. Meanwhile, Mr. Pickwick and his friends, having walked their blood into active circulation, proceeded cheerfully on. It was a fine, dry, bracing afternoon, the sort that might induce a couple of elderly gentlemen to take off their greatcoats and play at leapfrog in pure lightness of heart and gaiety. Indeed, if Mr. Tupman had offered a back, it was highly probable that Mr. Pickwick would have accepted his offer. No such chance occurred, however, for as they turned into a lane they had to cross, the sound of voices burst upon their ears.
It's Wardle.
They've come to meet
us. My dear friend.
Glad to see you all safe and sound and looking so hearty. Upon my word. How do, Tupman? Winkle? Snodgrass?
Oh, this is kind of you, Wardle. Most kind.
Joe came for your luggage?
Oh, yes, indeed. We would have been burdened otherwise.
Now then, do you know everybody? My daughter, Emily,
yes,
you've met.
Of course.
Miss Emily.
Looking prettier than ever, I do swear.
Thank you, Mr. Pickwick. How are you, Mr. Snodgrass?
In Elysium at this moment, Miss Emily.
But I believe this young lady is a stranger to you. Oh. Pickwick, Tupman, Snodgrass, meet Miss Arabella Allen, who's come down to be with us at the wedding.
How do you do, Miss Allen?
How do you do, gentlemen?
Oh, and Mr. Winkle.
Mr. Winkle?
Miss Allen.
Miss Arabella Allen was a very pretty black-eyed young lady, with an arch smile and a pair of remarkably nice boots with fur round the tops. Mr. Winkle's heart gave a positive jump as he looked at her, and in his mind he began instantly to perform prodigies of skill by which he might earn her regard.
And here are the happy couple.
Oh!
Lagging behind as usual, always wanting to be together. Isabella, my love, you remember Mr. Pickwick and his friends?
Yes, indeed. How do you do?
How do you do?
Her husband-to-be, George Trundle.
This is a pleasure, gentlemen.
You're a lucky fellow, Mr. Trundle. I wish I were 30 years younger. I might compete for your prize.
Believe me, I know my good fortune, Mr. Pickwick. I hope always to be deserving of it.
Yes. We've been down to inspect the furniture and fittings of the house they're to occupy after the Christmas holidays.
Oh, really? How interesting.
Mr. Wardle?
What is it, Tupman?
Where is
Miss Rachel?
My sister. Oh, she's at home, completing the Christmas decorations.
She's not as young as she was, Mr. Tupman. It was rather cold for her.
Aye, and it's too cold for us to stand about.
Yes, indeed.
Best foot forward, everybody, and we'll be at Dingley Dell in 10 minutes.
It was a pleasant 10 minutes for all concerned, except Mr. Tupman, in whose breast indignation had swelled at the slightly derogatory mention of Miss Rachel. For in his eyes, she was a beautiful young woman, as in hers he was a handsome young man. On the way, there were two stiles to negotiate, and it is worthy of remark that Mr. Snodgrass offered Miss Emily Wardle far more assistance than the terrors of the stile would seem to demand, while the young lady with the fur round her boots was observed to scream very loudly when Mr. Winkle offered to help her out.
Here we are, my friends. Welcome to Dingley Dell. The door stands open. In you go and warm yourselves.
Oh, upon my soul, what do I see? Miss Rachel on the top step waiting to welcome us. My dear Miss Rachel.
Dear Mr. Tupman, how do you do?
Rachel, you're a fool to stand out here without a shawl over your shoulders. Go inside, for goodness sake.
In a moment, brother. My dear Mr. Tupman, how do you do?
Miss Rachel, what a pleasure to see you.
Arabella, do you see what Aunt Rachel's holding? It's a sprig of mistletoe.
She brought it out on purpose.
Come inside. Don't let's spoil the two old dears' pleasure.
Hurry up, everybody. There's hot punch waiting if that rascal Joe hasn't fallen asleep again.
Miss Rachel, pray remain a moment.
Mr. Tupman.
What is it you have in your hand?
My hand? Why, I declare...
Is it not mistletoe?
I was doing the decorations. When I heard you come, I quite forgot I was holding it.
Permit me, Miss Rachel.
Mr. Tupman, what are you doing with it?
I'm claiming a Christmas privilege, Miss Rachel.
But if they were social and happy outside the house, what was the warmth and cordiality when they entered the comfortable parlour? The very servants grinned with pleasure at the sight of Mr. Pickwick. The smell of rich viands greeted their nostrils, and even the logs in the great fireplace seemed to crackle and blaze brighter. Seated by the fire in her customary state was Mr. Wardle's mother. The old lady was feeling rather cross, and by consequence, particularly deaf. She never went out herself, and like a great many other old ladies of the same stamp, she was apt to consider it an act of domestic treason if anybody else took the liberty of doing what she couldn't.
Mother, you remember Mr. Pickwick?
Never mind. Don't trouble Mr. Pickwick about an old creature like me. Nobody cares about me now, and it's very natural they shouldn't.
Come, come, Mrs. Wardle. I can't let you cut an old friend in this way. I've come down precisely to have a long talk with you and a rubber of whist. But you and I will show these boys and girls how to dance a minuet before they're 8 and 40 hours old.
What's he saying? I can't hear him.
She's a little cross today on account of losing Bella. But she'll come round. Ah, Joe, you brought the punch. Good boy. This will take the cold out of your bones, Pickwick.
Yes, indeed.
Now, to my good friends and relations, good health. God bless you all.
God bless you all.
A superb punch, Wardle.
Oh, good. Take another glass.
Thank you, I will.
Now, let's all gather round the fire and be comfortable.
The decorations aren't finished yet, Papa.
Well, hurry up, then. You've plenty of hands to help you.
If I might, Miss Emily.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Snodgrass. This holly is to go round all the people.
Miss Allen, might I assist?
Well, if you would help me with this trailing ivy.
Oh, do you need to ask, Miss Allen?
Miss Rachel, I think you had an interrupted task. The mistletoe, I believe?
It's to be suspended from that beam in the ceiling. If you could contrive to manage it, dear Mr. Tupman. The steps are in position.
No sooner said than done, Miss Rachel.
Take care, Tupman. Now, you are heavier than you think.
I'm perfectly safe. Thank you.
Hold the steps, Tupman, they're wobbling.
I've got them. You're right, Tupman.
Can't quite reach. If I get onto the top step...
Oh, be careful.
Oh, Mr. Tupman! Don't crowd round him. Give him air.
His eyes are closed. Speak, dear Mr. Tupman. Say you are not dead.
Don't be a fool, Rachel. Of course he's not dead. The breath's knocked out of him, that's all. A glass of brandy, somebody.
Yes, I'll get it.
That'll bring him round quicker than anything. Heave-ho, old fellow. Rest your head against my knee.
The brandy, Mr. Noble.
Try and take a little of this, Tupman.
Make the effort, Tupman.
He's opened his eyes.
That's it. Don't hurry.
He recovers. He revives.
Now, drop more.
Thank you.
He speaks.
Now, how are you? Do you feel any bones broken?
No. I think I'm quite unharmed. A little wind, that's all.
Your fat saved you, I expect. Up with you now.
Let me help you.
Thanks, Trunkle. We'll get you to a chair, Tupman.
No, the sofa will be better. He needs to recline.
Perhaps that would be best.
There you are, then. Now, do you feel yourself comfortable?
Thank you. Yes, indeed.
Have this cushion, Mr. Tupman.
And my shawl, you poor dear.
Let me bathe your temples with my lavender water. There's nothing so soothing.
Pray, dear ladies, I beg you. You treat my misfortune too kindly. It was entirely my own fault. I wasn't thinking of what I was doing.
That is true. Ah, Joe, you brought some eatables. Good. Now, time for a little snack, everybody. Hand around, Joe, while I refill the glasses. You can manage a mince pie, Tupman?
Would be sustaining.
What were you thinking of when you fell, Mr. Tupman?
A little poem had entered my mind. At the precise moment of my accident, I was endeavoring to find a rhyme for mistletoe.
What's that? I never knew you wrote poetry, Tupman. I thought that was our friend Snodgrass's line.
I bow, of course, to my friend's superior genius, but I have written a few poor things of my own.
Well, you speak some of them to us.
Oh, no, Miss Rachel. They must remain forever in obscurity. Like the work of an unfortunate author I once heard of.
A poet? Did I know him?
Not a poet, Snodgrass. A writer of fiction. Oh. I never knew him myself. In fact, the story was told to me by the waiter at an inn I used to frequent.
A story? How exciting!
Oh,
may we not dance, Mr. Chapman?
Splendid notion. Christmas is just the time for stories. But not now, Isabella.
Oh, Papa!
No, dinner will be on the table shortly, and Tupman must regain his appetite. But we shall insist on hearing it tonight, Tupman.
I shall be only too happy to oblige the company.
The rest of the day passed happily but quietly, for the remaining preparations for the morrow's wedding were in hand. Sedate and solemn were the scores of rubbers of whist in which Mr. Pickwick and the old lady played together, old Mrs. Wardle being very sharp after her winnings. In the kitchen, Mr. Weller had discovered a very pretty young servant called Emma, with whom he was very willing to indulge in a little flirting. And altogether, the parties both upstairs and downstairs were contented and replete. At last a lull came over the party. The hour grew late, and it was then that Mr. Pickwick remembered.
Tupman, you promised to tell us a story.
That's right.
Upon my word, so it is.
Yes. About an author.
Please, Mr. Tupman.
What's the story called, Tupman?
Yes, it must have a title. Every story must have a title.
I suppose, for the want of a better, one might call it Somebody's Luggage.
Somebody's Luggage? That's an odd title.
It was an odd happening. And it all took place in one of those good old-fashioned inns that specialize in the bed and coffee room business. The inn was called the George, and the waiter...
That's the man who told you the story.
Yes, Miss Helen.
Don't interrupt, Arabella. Sorry, Mr. Tupman.
Oh, my dear young lady. Where was I? The waiter, whose name was Christopher, had, through long experience and excellent qualifications, just been engaged. On the first day of his employment, he was instructed in his duties by Mrs. Pratchett, the chambermaid.
Now then, Christopher, numbers 26, 27, 28 and 31 along this corridor has 6 o'clock dinners, being commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Then they catch the night mail train, so they has to be served promptly.
And prompt they shall be served, ma'am. Mm.
But you ain't mentioned this door, Mrs. Pratchett.
What, number 24B? Oh, nobody in there. Never has been in the 5 years I've been chambermaid here.
Bad room, eh?
No, not that I knows of. Missus just don't let it. Here, what's you opening the door for?
Just taking a look. Yes. Fairish sort of room, if you could see it. Let's pull back the curtains. Yes, better. You might dust in here now and again.
What's the good if it's never used?
Hello, hello, what's that?
What's what?
That pile of stuff under the bed.
Oh, that. That's somebody's luggage.
Whose luggage?
Lord, Christopher, I don't know, nor any other servant in the house. Missus is the only person that'd be able to tell you, or Miss Martin. She keeps the books.
There's an awful lot of it. You mean it's been here since before you came?
Could have been here 20 years, for all I know.
Oh, no, 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 it's not that old. It's curious. Very curious.
Oh, that's for me. You'll remember about the dinners?
Don't fuss yourself, girl. I'll remember.
But that somebody's luggage weighed heavily on Christopher's mind. He fell to wondering more and more who this somebody was and what he'd been up to. He determined, on his next off-duty period, to examine the luggage and see if he could find a clue.
Black portmanteau, black bag, dressing case, hat box, umbrella and walking stick, brown paper parcel. Now, why should a gent go leaving all this behind?
Christopher?
Oh, Miss Martin.
Mrs. Pratchett told me she saw you sneaking in here. Why, I've gone and pulled that luggage out from under the bed. Suppose that gentleman was to come back and find you'd been prying into it.
I've not pried, my dears. I simply looked at it. Though I won't say I've not been tempted to open that portmanteau and that there black bag. The hat box, now. Well, there might be that in there as would make a co stop and speculate.
You don't mean... Oh, Christopher, not murder!
No, I don't. Because you can't have a murder without blood.
Oh.
And if there was a head in there...
Oh, Christopher, don't!
I'm not saying the box would be damp after all this time.
Oh.
But it would be mildewed. And there ain't a sign of mildew, as you can see.
Oh, put the horrid thing down, for heaven's sake. Oh, Christopher, why don't you shut up the room and forget all about it?
Yeah, I can't do that, my dear. I sense a mystery here, and I'd like to get to the bottom of it. You two can cut along if you like.
We will. Ooh. Come on, Miss Martin.
Can you wait a bit? Miss Martin, would you do just one little thing for me?
So long as it's not to open anything.
Only your account book, my love. Make me a copy of the gentleman's bill for the period he stayed here.
Exactly, you mean?
Every little item, leaving out nothing.
I can't do it right away.
A day or two will be all right. Don't hurry yourself, my dear.
But when the details came, they did nothing to assuage Christopher's curiosity.
Well, these are as curious a couple of bills as I ever did see. December the 30th. Pen and paper. Glass of negus. Another glass of negus. Pen and paper, anchovy toast, pen and paper, bed. Total, including broken tumbler, 16 shillings. December the 31st, pen and paper. Breakfast, pen and paper. Blotting paper, messenger to Paternoster Row and back. Messenger again, no answer. Brandy and double pork chop, pen and paper. Messenger to Albemarle Street and back. Large orange liqueur brandy, dinner, bottle of Old East India brown sherry, pen and paper. Total with previous bill, £2.16. All them pens and paper. That's the mystery. What did he want them for?
You there, Christopher? Mrs. wants you downstairs. How's the detective work getting on?
You don't get on at all, girl. It's fair baffling. Where is the missus?
In the coffee room.
You'll tell her I'm a coming. You wanted me, ma'am?
Ah, yes, Christopher. Come over here by the desk, will you? I want to have a little talk with you.
I hope, ma'am, as you've no fault to find with my work.
No fault at all. You're a good waiter, Christopher.
Oh, thank you, ma'am.
Even if you do have something heavy weighing on your mind.
Eh?
Oh, yes, the girls have told me. Somebody's luggage.
Oh.
Miss Martin, give me the account book, will you?
Here you are, ma'am.
Thank you. Now, Christopher,
The items that were left in number 24B. You've got them all by heart, I know.
I have, ma'am.
Nothing opened and nothing tampered with.
All locked, ma'am. And the brown paper parcel sealed.
Right. Now, Christopher, I'm going to make you a handsome offer. Pay me somebody's bill and you shall have somebody's luggage.
There's a bargain for you. All for,
let me see. £2.16 and sixpence.
It mightn't be worth it, ma'am.
That's the lottery. Now, won't you venture £2.16 and six in a lottery? Why, there are no blanks. You must win. Draw a blank and you're still entitled to somebody's luggage.
Oh, go on, Christopher, do.
Well, you persuaded me, ma'am. It's a bargain.
Good. Bravo, Christopher.
Here's the money, ma'am. And I'll have the key of the apartment, if you don't mind, ma'am, and any other keys.
He may have left. Here you are, Christopher. And here's my hand on our bargain.
Yeah.
On his first free afternoon, Christopher locked himself in number 24B and opened somebody's luggage. There was a certain amount of wearing apparel, not bad what there was of it, but the most astonishing thing was that between every item was the most extraordinary quantity of writing paper, and all written on. There was no heading to any of the writings, and all were totally illegible, blotted and smeared across as they were with ink. Christopher gazed upon his findings for some little time.
Well, this is a rum do, I must say. I suppose the clothes and the bits and bobs will fetch something, but as for this here writing, into the fireplace you go. And if it's family papers I'm going to burn, all I can say is you shouldn't have left them here. Now, all I've got left to open is that there brown paper parcel. Well, you can wait till I've burned this little lot.
A visit to a second-hand clothes dealer reimbursed Christopher his £2.16 and sixpence, with a little over. And the following afternoon, locked once more in number 24B, he broke the seals of the brown paper parcel.
Now, me beauty, if you've got no more than smeary writings in you, into the hearth you go as well. Hello? Well, this is a change, I must say. Well, they're writings, but I can read them. What's this? Monsieur Mutuel, a short story. Yeah, proper stories, too, with talking in them.
Oh, so that's it.
He was an author. That's what all the pens and paper was for, and all the messengers to Paternoster Row. Well, I bought you along with the rest of his luggage, so you're mine, like all the other things. But what to do with you? That's the problem.
For several nights and days, Christopher pondered on what he should do with the stories. Then, one evening, he parcelled them all up in a large envelope and under the shadow of night slipped them into the letterbox of a great publishing house. But somehow, from the moment of that action, peace of mind fled from him. He knew if ever he was confronted by somebody, he could not deny his theft. And what the consequences might be, he shuddered to think. Then, one evening in November, when he was alone in the coffee room...
Yes, he's over there. Christopher, Someone asking for you.
Me?
There he is, sir.
Thank you, ma'am. Mr. Christopher, head waiter.
That's right, sir.
I've something for you, Mr. Christopher. Something you've probably been expecting. The proofs, sir. AYR.
The what?
Just proofs, Mr. Christopher. As I said, AYR. Coming out at Christmas. Good day to you, sir.
AYR? What's that mean? Anticipate your retribution? Audacious youth, repent. Oh, my God. And the proof is in this packet, I suppose. It's them stories. They're printed. I knew I should never have done it. And the proof is coming out at Christmas. I'd better go and hang myself.
Christopher, the commercials are just coming in.
What?
Christopher, you've not laid all your tables. Mm. Hurry.
Be done in a minute, ma'am. Just getting me cutlery.
Good evening, sir. Can I help you?
Yes. I'd like a room, if you have one.
Certainly, sir. Miss Martin, what have we for you?
You can have number 27 or 28, sir. They're both vacant.
Can you give me number 24B?
Christopher.
Beg pardon, ma'am. My hand slipped.
Yes, we can let you have number 24B, but it will be an hour or so before it's ready.
Then I'll take dinner first, ma'am.
Very good, sir. Christopher, show this gentleman to a table.
Yes, ma'am. Will you come this way, sir?
No, I won't sit over there. I'd rather sit here, number four.
Number four? But it's all ink stained.
I know it is. I made it so. Now, What's the bill of fare?
Fish, soup, joint, bird, winter cabbage and apple pudding, sir.
I'll have the fish and the joint and a bottle of the old East Indian brown sherry.
Oh, yes, sir.
And waiter,
sir,
bring me ink, pen and paper. And I shall need a messenger to go to the Cornhill.
Right away, sir.
During his dinner, the gentleman wrote three letters, watched all the time by Christopher from behind his screen. Then, on being informed that number 24B had been prepared for him, the gentleman departed upstairs. Christopher waited in fear and trembling for the storm to descend upon him, for the hand of God to strike him dead. But nothing happened. The gentleman came downstairs again, ordered an orange brandy, and began writing furiously once more.
Christopher!
What is it, Mrs. Pritchett?
He's been upstairs. He's been looking for his luggage everywhere.
Oh.
He threw himself bodily under the bedstead.
Oh, that don't matter. I'll give him back his £2.16 and 6 and welcome. It's the...
The what?
Never you mind. Go away.
Oh! He's calling you.
I know that. Go away.
Oh.
You called me, sir?
Yes, I need another messenger. This time to go to Farringdon Street.
Sir.
Well, go on. Why don't you move? Don't stand staring at me like that.
Sir, if you please. I have something to tell you.
No?
It concerns what's in this envelope, sir. And I think what's in it belongs to you.
To me?
And I must humbly plead guilty to being the culprit, sir. Would you please open it, sir?
Great heavens! What's this? Print!
Yes, sir. I do acknowledge being the unfortunate cause of it, sir. And now you've got the proof of what I did.
My dear, dear fellow, what's your name?
Christopher, sir, and I hope, sir, when you've heard my explanation...
Print in print, and in AYR, and to the bargain.
Does that mean I am to anticipate my retribution, sir?
What? Oh, nonsense, nonsense. It's short for all the year round. The finest magazine in existence.
A magazine?
Oh, Christopher, nothing can recompense you. From boyhood, I've struggled unremittingly and unavailingly to get into print. I have unprinted reams, and now... My dear fellow, would you find £20 acceptable?
Then you didn't mind me looking through your luggage, sir?
Mind? I left that luggage here on the desperate chance that someone less accursed than myself might give them to the world. And destiny, choosing her agent from all mankind, sent you here.
Oh.
But I must correct these proofs. Bring me more pens and inkstands, Christopher, and you and I will share a bottle of the orange brandy while I do it.
All night long the gentleman labored. Pens spluttered and ink flew till number 4 table was more spotted than ever. In the grey dawn, Christopher was dispatched in a four-wheeler to take the corrections to the printing office of the great publishing house. And Christopher and the gentleman settled down to wait for the giving of their first-born child to the world.
Sir? Sir, come here to the window.
Well, what's the matter? Should the cab stopped outside?
But that young gentleman what's got out of it and is a-coming in here, he's from AYR, sir. He's come here before.
Ah, Mr. Christopher. Just the person I wanted to see.
Good morning, sir.
I have a packet for you, Mr. Christopher, from all the year round. Here, sir, with the compliments of the season.
And to you, sir.
Good morning.
This'll be for you, sir.
Yes, my advance copy. Shake hands with me, Christopher.
With pleasure, sir.
Now, to see what they look like. What on earth's this?
But what's up, sir?
They've returned the proofs.
Why should they do that, sir?
There's a letter here. Oh, no. Oh, no. Read it, Christopher. Tell me my eyes are deceiving me.
Dear sir...
Never mind that. Go on.
The publishing house of All the Year Round is obliged to inform you that the resources of the whole establishment was unable to read the proofs you returned.
Oh.
And in consequence, regrets its inability to publish any of the stories.
My infant child, stillborn, stillborn.
Oh, sir, you went and did it again. Why did you have to blot and smear so much? Now then, things I rescued and sold for you won't never get into print at all.
Oh. Oh, what a shame. The poor silly author.
I don't think it's funny at all. I feel for that poor man. Indeed, I do.
Well, anyway, it was a capital story, Tupman.
Yes,
capital.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You're all too kind.
And now it's time for bed, everybody. We have to be up bright and early in the morning. All the candlesticks ready, Joe?
Yes, Master.
Listen. Ah, it's the waits. They come miles every Christmas to give us this pleasure. Joe, run and give them this half crown. God bless them.
And I will. And gladly, sir.
Now, this is really like Christmas.
Yes,
Christmas in the country. There's nothing to compare with it. Off to bed with you, my dears. Off to bed.
Mr. Pickwick was awakened early in the morning by a hum of voices and a pattering of feet sufficient even to arouse the fat boy from his heavy slumbers. He sat up in bed and listened. The female servants and the female visitors were constantly running to and fro, and there were such multitudinous demands for hot water and such repeated outcries for needles and thread that Mr. Pickwick, in his innocence, began to imagine that something dreadful must have occurred. Then he remembered the wedding.
Come in. Ah, Sam, good morning.
Morning, sir. And a very bright and cheerful morning it is, as we fix this here splendid occasion.
Ah, so I see.
I brought your shaving water, sir. And I'm going to put out your clothes, if you'll tell me what it is as you require.
My best, of course, Sam.
Naturally, sir. And that'll be the blue coat and the buff pantaloons, I'm figuring.
And the sprigged waistcoat, Sam.
No sooner said than done, sir. And while you're a-shaving, I'll just give your top boots a bit of extra polish.
God bless my soul. Whatever's that?
That's a bridesmaid, sir.
Oh?
Very high-spirited they are.
So I should think.
And as pretty a bevy of young ladies as you ever saw. They'll have been helping to dress the bride.
Ah, yes.
Shall I help you, sir?
No, Sam, I'll dress myself. But go and see if you can help any of my friends, or indeed if any of Mr. Wardle's servants need assistance in their duties.
Are you sure you don't need me anymore, sir?
No, Sam. Go along, sir.
Within an hour, the carriages were at the door. All the Pickwickians were in most blooming array, and there was a terrific roaring in front of the house, occasioned by all the men, boys, and hobbledehoys attached to the farm, all of whom were cheering with might and main, being incited thereunto and stimulated therein by the precept and example of Mr. Samuel Weller.
Three cheers for the bride! Hip hip!
Aye!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
And three cheers for Mr. Wardle, what give it to the world! Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Many and varied were the feelings of those who rode to the little parish church of Dingley Dell. Mr. Pickwick, Mr. Winkle, and Mr. Snodgrass sat in the foremost pew, but Mr. Tupman had contrived to seat himself beside Miss Rachel Wardle.
Sad occasion, this, Mr. Tupman, don't you think?
Sad, but beautiful, dear Miss Rachel. Beautiful when you think of two loving hearts joined together.
Yes, indeed.
Ah, the bride is coming now. Be ready, Mr. Trundle.
Mr. Pickwick, I'll be good to her. I swear I'll devote my life to her.
To be sure you will, my dear boy. That is what you are about to affirm. Take your place now.
Yes.
Oh, how beautiful Isabella looks. As beautiful as an angel.
Almost as beautiful as her aunt, Miss Rachel.
What a sweet girl Emily Wardle is.
She looked at me. Miss Allen looked at me.
We are gathered together here in the sight of God and in the face of this congregation to join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony, which is an honorable estate.
And so into the vestry where the register was signed and where Mr. Pickwick was the first to salute the bride. And in so doing, threw over her neck a rich gold watch and chain, which no mortal eyes but the jeweler's had ever seen before. If the wedding in the church was a solemn occasion, the wedding breakfast was an occasion of joy. Many were the toasts that were drunk.
Water, a glass of wine in honor of this happy day. God bless you, my dear friend.
And you, my boy, I pledge you.
Then Mr. Pickwick pledged Mrs. Wardle, and then Mr. Tupman. Then Mr. Tupman pledged the spinster aunt, and Mr. Winkle pledged the bridesmaids. Mr. Snodgrass pledged Miss Emily Wardle, and somebody pledged two poor relations who had been forgotten. Then the cake was cut, and the young ladies saved pieces to put under their pillows and dream of their future husbands on, and a great deal of blushing and merriment was thereby occasioned. Finally...
Ladies and gentlemen!
Speech!
Be quiet, sir.
Oh, beg pardon, sir. Be quiet, young dropsy.
Oh, I said a word. I was eating. Ladies and gentlemen. No, I won't say ladies and gentlemen.
Time!
Sam.
Sorry, sir.
I will say instead my friends. My very dear friends. Oh, if the ladies will allow me to take so great a liberty.
I'd like to kiss that dear Mr. Pickwick.
Can't it be done by deputy, Miss Allen?
Oh, go away, you dreadful man.
My dear friends, I am going to propose the health of the bride and bridegroom. Uh-huh. God bless them.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Fuller was always my friend, Sneed.
Compose yourself, dear Miss Rachel.
My young friend, Trundle, I believe to be a very excellent and manly fellow. Yeah. And his wife, I know, to be a very amiable and lovely girl. Yes. Well qualified to transfer to another sphere the happiness which for 20 years she has diffused around her in her father's house. Yes.
I always loved her. I did.
Sorry, young twenty son.
I wish I was young enough to be her sister's husband. Failing that, I am happy to be old enough to be her father. For being so, I shall not be suspected of any latent design. When I say that I admire, esteem, and love them both. The bride's father, our good friend here by my side, is a noble person, and I am proud to know him. That his daughter may enjoy all the happiness that even he can desire, and that he may derive from the contemplation of her felicity all the gratification and peace of mind which he so well deserves, is, I am persuaded, our united wish. So let us drink their health and wish them prolonged life and every blessing. The bride and groom.
The wedding breakfast at length concluded. A 25-mile walk was undertaken by the males at Wardle's recommendation to get rid of the effects of the wine at breakfast. Restored by the exercise, the company met again at dinner, which was quite as hearty, without the tears, and quite as noisy. Then came the dessert and more toasts. Then came the tea and coffee, and then the ball.
May I claim the first dance of you, Miss Rachel?
Of course you may, dear Mr.
And the next? And the next, perhaps?
Mr. Tupman. Well, we shall see.
Tupman, have you seen Pickwick?
No, why?
Well, look over there. He's just come in.
God bless my soul. It's incredible.
The reason for the astonishment of the two Pickwickians was that Mr. Pickwick's legs were no longer encompassed by gaiters for the first time within the memory of his oldest friends. Instead, His lower extremities were encased in speckly silk stockings and smartly tied pumps.
He looks so odd.
Well, Snodgrass. Well, Tupman. All ready for the dance?
Hey, quick. You haven't got your gaiters on.
Quite right, Tupman. I have not.
But this is the first time I've ever seen you without them. Hey, Snodgrass.
You can't mean you're going to dance.
I do. As you see, I am dressed for the purpose.
But you in silk stockings.
And why not, sir? Why not?
Of course, there's no reason why you shouldn't wear them.
I imagine not. Sir, I imagine not. You see nothing extraordinary in the stockings. Stockings, I trust, sir?
Certainly not. No, certainly not.
Thank you. I am glad to hear it, sir.
Now, everybody, take your partners for Sir Roger de Coverley.
Mrs. Wardle, ma'am, will you do me the honor? Sir Roger de Coverley, ma'am, with me.
Why, Mr. Pickwick, you don't want to bother with an old woman like me.
I insist, ma'am, that the head of such a fine family, looking herself so well and bonny, shall lead off with us.
Hurry up, everybody. Isabella, George, take your places.
Miss Emily, may I have the honor?
Indeed you may, Mr. Snodgrass.
That's right. Form up, everybody. Now, are we ready?
Wait a minute, Papa. Where's Arabella Allen?
And Winkle.
Arabella! There they are in the corner.
Come along, both of you. You're holding up the dance. Oh,
what an extraordinary thing it is, Winkle, that you couldn't have taken your place before.
Not at all extraordinary.
Oh, well, I don't know that it is so extraordinary after all.
Right up.
Up struck the two fiddles and the harp, and away went Mr. Pickwick, hands across, down the middle to the very end of the room, and halfway up the chimney. Back again to the door, poussette everywhere, loud stamp on the ground, ready for the next couple, off again, all the figures over once more, next couple, and the next again. Never was such going. And still did Mr. Pickwick, after they had reached the bottom of the dance, full 14 couple after the old lady had retired and the clergyman's wife had been substituted in her stead, still did that gentleman, when there was no demand on his exertions, keep perpetually dancing in his place to keep time to the music, all the while with a blandness of demeanor which baffles all description.
My dear fellow, take a rest.
Huh?
We go down to the kitchen soon.
No.
I like to include the servants at Christmas, so we take supper with them down there.
Pardon the word. I feel I could go on forever. I've never spent such a Christmas.
I like to do things in the old style. Too many of the good old ways are dying out. One more dance, my friends, then down to the kitchen for supper.
So, your family has games in the kitchen tonight, eh, Emma, my dear?
Oh, Mr. Weather. Yes, we always have on Christmas Eve. Master wouldn't neglect to keep it up on any account. There now, table's all ready.
I never see such a sensible man as he is.
are such a regular gentleman.
Oh, there's nobody like Mr. Wardle. He's the best master anyone could have.
And don't he breed nice pork?
Oh, you've woken up at last, have you? Mm. I'll tell you what, young boa constrictor. If you don't sleep a little less and exercise a little more, when you comes to be a man, you'll lay yourself open to the same sort of personal inconvenience as was inflicted in the old gentleman as wore the pigtail.
Oh, what did they do to him?
I'm going to tell you. He was one of the largest patterns that was ever turned out. Regular fat man as hadn't caught a glimpse of his own shoes for 5 and 40 years.
Look!
If you'd have put an exact model of his legs on the dining table afore him, he wouldn't have known him. Well, he always walked to his office with a very handsome gold watch and chain hanging out, about 1¼ feet, and a gold watch in his fob pocket. You'd better not carry that there watch, says the old gentleman's friends. You'll be robbed on it, says they. Shall I, says he? I'd like to see the thief as could get this here watch out, for I'm blessed if I can. It's such a tight fit. Whenever I want to know what's o'clock, I'm obliged to stare into the baker's shop.
Who just thought it?
In fact, there weren't a pickpocket in all London as didn't take a pull at that chain. But it'd never break, and the watch had never come out. So they soon get tired of dragging such a heavy old gentleman along the pavement.
Hey, Joe, you listening?
I of course I am.
Oh. Well, one day, the old gentleman was rolling along when he sees a pickpocket he knows by sight, coming up arm in arm with a little boy with a very large head. Here's a game, thinks the old gentleman. They're going to have another try, but it don't do. So, he begins chuckling where he are. Then all of a sudden, the little boy leaves hold of the pickpocket's arm and rushes head foremost into the old gentleman's stomach, and for a moment doubles him right up with a pain. And then he comes straight again.
The watch and chain was gone.
That's right, my dear. And what was worse than that, the old gentleman's digestion was all wrong ever afterwards.
Oh, how terrible.
So, you just look about you, young fella, and take care you don't get too fat.
Ah. Oh, Mr. Weller, here's the company coming.
And afore they arise, my dear, I'm going to take advantage of that there mistletoe your master hanged up himself.
Oh, no, Mr. Weller.
As soon as the company had entered the kitchen, this same huge branch of mistletoe instantaneously gave rise to a scene of general and delightful struggling and confusion. Mr. Pickwick, with old-world courtesy, took the old lady by the hand and saluted her beneath the mystic bough. Mr. Winkle kissed Miss Arabella Allen, Mr. Tupman kissed Miss Rachel, Mr. Snodgrass kissed Emily Wardle, and Mr. Weller kissed all the rest of the female servants. Then all the young ladies, after a great deal of whispering among them, darted forward and kissed Mr. Pickwick, who was pulled first this way and then that, kissed on the chin, then on the nose, and then on the spectacles. During which time, Mr. Wardle stood with his back to the fire, surveying the whole scene with the utmost satisfaction, while the fat boy took the opportunity of appropriating for his own use a particularly fine mince pie that had been carefully put by for somebody else.
Right, my friends, now for the game. Of course you must play.
And play everybody did. First, Blind Man's Buff till everyone was exhausted, then Snapdragon. And when Fingers Enough had been burnt at that and all the raisins were gone, they sat down by a huge fire of blazing logs to a substantial supper and a mighty bowl of wassail, something smaller than an ordinary washhouse copper, in which hot apples were hissing and bubbling with a rich look and a jolly sound that was perfectly irresistible.
Fill your glasses, one and all. Don't spare it, friends. We haven't seen the bottom of the wassail bowl before we part company. Bestir yourself, Jones.
Oh, this is indeed comfort and cheerfulness.
How I like to spend Christmas. Family and friends about me. And here we sit till the clock strikes 12. Trundle, my boy, put more logs on. Send the fire roaring up the chimney.
I just looked out of door. It's beginning to snow again.
I thought it might.
There's a wind gone on too. It's going to freeze hard.
What does he say? There's nothing the matter, is there?
No, no, Mother. Only that it's bitter cold outside. We'll end your visit, my friends, by skating on the pond.
You skate, of course, Winkle.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Oh, I'm so glad. I shall be able to watch you.
I'm very sorry to disappoint you, Miss Allen, but unfortunately I've no skates with me.
Don't let that stop you. We've plenty here.
Oh.
There you are. You see, you won't disappoint me after all.
Well, I am, of course, rather out of practice.
You'll soon get into it again. You'll see.
Oh.
Listen. Midnight.
Oh. What?
Midnight, Mother. Everybody's glass full?
Yes.
Fill them up, then.
Sam, give us a hand.
Right, you are, sir. Scurry round with them, young dropsy.
And fill your own, sir.
I have. Thank you, sir. You all are, yes.
Christmas Day. I give you a toast, my friends. Long life, health, and happiness. God bless you all.
God bless you all.
Merry Christmas.
Come in.
Morning, sir.
Morning, Sam. What sort of a day is it? Is it still frosty?
Water in the washhand basin's a mask of ice, sir.
Severe weather, Sam.
Fine for them, but it's well wrapped up, sir. As the polar bear said to himself when he was practicing his skating. You getting up now, sir?
Yes. I'll be down in a quarter of an hour.
Very good, sir. I'll pour out your shaving water. Oh, and, there's a couple of sawbones downstairs, sir. A
couple of what?
A couple of sawbones.
What's a sawbones?
What? Don't you know what a sawbones is, sir? I thought everybody knows that a sawbones was a surgeon.
Oh, a surgeon, eh?
Just that, sir. No, these ones here below ain't regular thoroughbred sawbones yet. They're only in training.
In other words, they're medical students, I suppose.
That's right, sir. Turned up this morning.
They're fine fellows, medical students. Fine fellows. The judgments matured by observation and reflection. The tastes refined by reading and study. I'm very glad of it.
They're smoking cigars by the kitchen fire.
Overflowing with kindly feelings and animal spirits. Just what I like to see.
And one of them's got his legs on the table and is drinking brandy neat. Well, the other one, him in the barnacles.
In the what?
Spectacles, sir. He's got a barrel of oysters between his knees and is opening them like steam. And as fast as he eats them, he takes aim with the shells at young Dropsy as they're sitting down fast asleep in the chimney corner.
The eccentricities of genius, Sam. You may retire.
Very good, sir.
Sam did retire accordingly, and Mr. Pickwick, at the expiration of a quarter of an hour, went down to breakfast.
Ah, here he is at last. Pickwick, I want you to meet Miss Allen's brother, Mr. Benjamin Allen. Ben, Mr. Pickwick.
How do you do, sir?
Mr. Benjamin Allen was a coarse, stout, thick-set young man, with black hair cut rather short and a white face cut rather long. He was embellished with spectacles and wore a white neckerchief. Below his single-breasted black surtout, which was buttoned up to the chin, appeared the usual number of pepper and salt-covered legs, terminating in a pair of imperfectly polished boots. Although his coat was short in the sleeves, it disclosed no vestige of a linen wristband, and although there was quite enough of his face to admit the encroachment of a shirt collar, it was not graced by the smallest approach to that appendage. He presented altogether a rather mildewy appearance, and emitted a strong odour of full-flavoured cigars.
And this is Ben's particular friend, Mr.
Sawyer.
Bob Sawyer. Mr. Pickwick.
Your servant, Mr. Sawyer. I wish you were, by gad. I could do with one, eh, Ben? Pass the bread, will you?
Mr. Bob Sawyer, who was habited in a coarse blue coat, had about him that sort of slovenly smartness and swaggering gait which is peculiar to young gentlemen who smoke in the streets by day and scream in the same by night, call waiters by their Christian names, and do various other acts and deeds of an equally facetious description. He wore a pair of plaid trousers and a large, rough, double-breasted waistcoat. Out of doors, he carried a thick stick with a big top, eschewed gloves, and looked, upon the whole, something like a dissipated Robinson Crusoe.
What'll you take, Pickwick?
A little of the beef, I think.
Joe, serve Mr. Pickwick. Thank you, Joe. Have you come far this morning, gentlemen?
Blue Lion Muggleton.
Oh, you should have joined us last night, eh, Wardlaw?
So we should. The brandy was too good to leave in a hurry, wasn't it, Ben?
Certainly was. And the pork chops weren't bad, nor the cigar neither. Pass the beef, Pickwick.
Oh, and the mustard.
Thanks.
Where are my three friends, Wardle?
They went for a walk with the ladies to work up an appetite. They'll be back directly. Try a deviled kidney, Pickle.
Oh, thank you, I will.
Talking of kidneys, did one first thing yesterday.
I beg your pardon?
Dissected it. Nothing like dissecting a corpse to give one an appetite. No.
So I perceive.
By the way, Bob, have you finished that boy's leg yet?
Not nearly. A very muscular one for a child.
I put my name down for an arm at our place. Oh. We're clubbing for a subject. List is nearly full. Only we can't get hold of any fellow that wants a head. Wish you'd take it.
No, can't afford expensive luxuries. No.
Nonsense.
I wouldn't find a brain. I can't run to a whole head.
Gentlemen, please. I hear the ladies.
Oh, good morning, my dears.
Good morning, Mr. Pickwick.
We've a couple of visitors for you, Arabella.
Me?
Good morning, sister.
Why, Ben? Fancy you being here.
Come to take you home tomorrow.
Oh.
Fall to, everybody. We have to be at church in an hour.
Don't you see Bob Sawyer, Arabella? You've not said a word to him.
Good morning, Mr. Sawyer.
How do, Miss Allen?
I don't believe you and Ben have met Mr. Winkle.
I have not, but I shall be very happy to.
Here Mr. Allen bowed grimly to Mr. Winkle, while Mr. Winkle and Bob Sawyer glanced mutual distrust out of the corners of their eyes, enhanced on Mr. Winkle's part by the knowledge that Mr. Bob Sawyer had given Miss Arabella Allen's hand a perceptible squeeze. Indeed, the arrival of the two new visitors would, in all probability, have proved a very unpleasant interruption to the hilarity of the party, had not the cheerfulness of Mr. Pickwick and the unfailing good humour of the host been exerted to the very utmost for the common weal. So well did they succeed that Mr. Bob Sawyer, enlivened with the brandy and the breakfast, related with much glee an agreeable anecdote about the removal of a tumour from some gentleman's head, which he illustrated by means of an oyster knife and a half-quartern loaf, to the great edification of the assembled company. Breakfast over, the whole train went to church, which was followed by a substantial lunch, after which the question of skating was again raised by Mr. Wardle.
Now then, what do you say to an hour or two on the ice?
Oh!
We've plenty of time before dinner.
Oh, no, capital!
Time!
The pond's in fine condition, I understand. Joe, did you get the skates out?
I did, Master. Shall I go ahead with them?
If you please, Joe.
Sam, go with him and help him.
Got you, sir. Go on, young dropsy.
You're looking forward to a morning skating, I'll be bound, Winkle.
Yes, very much. Only, as I said before, I fear I'm rather out of practice.
You'll soon get into the way of it again. Well, if we're all ready, we'll lose no more time.
Mr. Wardle led the way to a pretty large sheet of ice, which had been swept clear of the snow which had fallen during the night.
There's Trundle and Isabella on the ice already. Hello there!
It's wonderful!
Mr. Bob Sawyer adjusted his skates with a dexterity which to Mr. Winkle was perfectly marvellous, and skimming onto the pond, described circles with his left leg and cut figures of eight, and inscribed upon the ice without once stopping for breath a great many other pleasant and astonishing devices. A pitch of positive enthusiasm was reached when old Wardle and Benjamin Allen, assisted by Bob Sawyer, performed some mystic evolutions which they call the reel.
Bravo! Bravo!
Oh, my Winkles, you haven't got your skates on yet.
Come along, Winkle. We're waiting for you to show us how it should be done.
I'm afraid these skates won't go off.
Let me give you a hand, sir.
Oh, you put them on backwards, sir. Yeah. Points go in front.
I thought they seemed a little odd.
I'm so looking forward to watching you, Mr. Winkle. Skating is so great, so swan-like.
There. That's the last strap, Buckle-chan. Up with you now, and show them how to do it.
Wait, Sam, wait. Walk with me to the edge.
Oh. Oh, slippery it is, Sam.
It's not an uncommon thing with ice, sir.
Oh, stop that!
This last observation of Mr. Weller's bore reference to a demonstration Mr. Winkle made at that instant of a frantic desire to throw his feet in the air and dash the back of his head on the ice.
These are very awkward skates, aren't they, Sam?
Oh, I'm afraid there's an awkward gentleman in them, sir.
Hurry up, Winkle. The ladies are all asleep.
Off you go now, chap.
No, no, Sam. Don't let go yet. Sam, I find I have a couple of coats at home I don't want.
You may have them, Sam.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Never mind touching your hat, Sam.
You didn't take your arm away to do that. I meant to give you 5 shillings this morning for a Christmas box. I'll give it to you this afternoon, Sam.
You're very good, sir.
Just hold me at first, Sam, will you, and steer me along.
No,
not too fast, Sam, not too fast.
While Mr. Winkle, his body half doubled up, was being assisted over the ice by Mr. Weller in a very singular and unswan-like manner, Mr. Pickwick's attention was drawn to Joe, who, awake for once, was busy shoveling snow from the brink of the pond.
What are you doing, Joe?
Oh, cutting a slide, sir, for them as don't skate.
Oh, an excellent idea. I'll get Sam to give you a hand.
Sam! Come here! I want you!
I'll have to let you go, Mr. Winkle, sir. The governor's calling.
No, no, Sam. Don't leave me. Not yet.
Sam!
I've got to go there. I'll just give you a push and you'll be fine.
No, don't! Stay, Sam! Stay!
But with a violent effort, Mr. Weller disengaged himself from the grasp of the anguished Pickwickian. And in so doing, administered a considerable impetus to the unhappy Mr. Winkle. With an accuracy no degree of dexterity could have ensured, that unfortunate gentleman bore swiftly down into the center of the company, who were then engaged in an energetic reel, at the very moment when Mr. Bob Sawyer was performing a flourish of unparalleled beauty. Mr. Winkle struck wildly against him, and with a loud crash, they both fell heavily down. Mr. Pickwick ran to the spot. Bob Sawyer had risen to his feet, but Mr. Winkle was far too wise to do anything of the kind on skates. He was seated on the ice making spasmodic attempts to smile, but anguish was depicted on every lineament of his countenance.
Winkle, are you hurt?
Not much, thank you. Just winded.
I wish you'd let me bleed you.
No, thank you. It's not necessary.
What do you think, Mr. Pickwick?
Take his skates off.
Oh, no!
Sam, take them off.
Yes, sir. No, really, I've scarcely begun.
Now, lift him up.
Easy, sir.
And help him to the edge of the pond.
Take it easy, sir. Just lean on me.
Steady.
You may leave us, Sam.
Yes, sir.
Now, sir, I will tell you what I think. Winkle, you are a humbug.
Oh, I say.
A humbug, sir. I will speak plainer if you wish it. An impostor, sir.
And with those words, Mr. Pickwick turned on his heel and rejoined his friends.
Mr. Winkle?
Miss Arabella?
You mustn't mind what happened. You did skim so beautifully over the ice just before you fell.
I'd have been all right, really I would, if I hadn't been so out of practice.
Of course you would.
During Mr. Winkle's pyrotechnics, the less active members of the party had been diverting themselves upon the slide. It was a good, long slide. And there was something in the motion which Mr. Pickwick, who was very cold with standing still, could not help envying.
I must say, that looks a nice warm exercise, Wardle.
Does indeed. Do you slide?
Oh, I used to once on the gutters when I was a boy.
Try it now.
Oh, yes. Oh, my dear friends, but I've not done such a thing in 30 years.
Never mind. I'll keep you company.
Away went Mr. Wardle, down the slide with a rapidity that beat the fat boy and Mr. Snodgrass and Mr. Tupman all to nothing. Mr. Pickwick paused, considered, took off his gloves and put them in his hat, took 2 or 3 short runs, balked himself as often, and at last took another run and went slowly and gravely down the slide with his feet about 1 yard and 1/4 apart.
Keep the boat a mile in, sir!
Down went Mr. Wardle again, then Mr. Pickwick and the rest, following closely upon each other's heels and running after each other with as much eagerness as if all their future prospects in life depended on their expedition.
That's the way of it, sir! You're doing fine!
A large mass of ice had disappeared and water bubbled over it. Mr. Pickwick's hat, gloves and handkerchief were floating on the surface, and that was all of Mr. Pickwick anyone could see.
Governor, where are you? Pickwick! Run for help, Chapman! Fire! He's all right. He's come up. Can you feel the bottom there, old fellow?
Yes, certainly. I fell on my back. I couldn't get on my feet.
All right, sir. I'm coming to you. Hold on to my heels, won't you, Mr. Wardle?
All right,
and I'll give Mr. Pickwick my hands. Grasp hold of me, sir.
Firm now, while we pull you out.
That's it, sir. You're a-coming.
Oh, well done, Sam. How do you feel, Pickwick?
Oh, he's soaking wet. Here, have my shawl.
Yes, wrap mine round him, too.
That's the best thing. Now, run home, Pickwick, as fast as your legs can carry you, and jump into bed directly.
I'll hold on to you, sir. Now, off together.
Away went Mr. Pickwick, under the guidance of Mr. Weller, presenting the singular phenomenon of an elderly gentleman, dripping wet and without a hat, with his arms bound down to his sides, skimming over the ground at the rate of 6 good English miles an hour. Nor did he pause an instant until he was snug in bed. Sam Weller lighted a blazing fire and took up his dinner, and afterwards a bowl of punch was carried up and a grand carouse held in honour of his safety.
This is most kind of you, Wardle.
Most kind. My dear fellow, since there was no question of your coming downstairs, why, we had to come upstairs to you. Drink up that punch now. It's a sure preventative against taking cold or getting the rheumatism.
I must say, I don't feel the slightest trace of either.
That's the lemon peel. Take no notice. Touch the bell, will you, Snodgrass, for Joe to bring up another bowl of punch?
Oh, my dear fellow.
It started to snow again.
Must you really go tomorrow, Mr. Tupman?
I fear we must, Miss Rachel.
It's not a bad road, and there are plenty of inns to put up at if the drifts get too deep.
God bless my soul, yes. Any number of inns.
He's feverish. Send for a doctor.
Oh, no, my dear sir. I am perfectly composed. It was your mention of inns. Oh, dear me. How I should have liked to have seen that inn.
What inn, Mr. Pickwick?
Tom Smart and the Widows.
Is it a story, Mr. Pickwick?
I was assured it was true, my dear. But of course I can't vouch for it. But it was strange, very strange indeed.
Tell us, Mr. Pickwick.
Just a minute. Here's Joe with the fresh punch.
Oh.
Put it down here, Joe, so everyone can help themselves. Now, fire away, Pickwick.
Well, one in winter's evening, about 5 o'clock, just as it was beginning to grow dark, Tom Smart, who was a bagman working for the great house of Bilson and Slum in the city, might have been seen in his gig urging his horse across Marlborough Down in the direction of Bristol. It was a vixenish little mare, but she and Tom knew each other, so she kept going until a heavy fall of snow and a mighty gust of wind brought her to a standstill.
Well, damn me steps and whiskers. This ain't pleasant, is it, me girl? No, I quite agree with you, lass. You want your stable, and so do I. First house we come to, we'll put up. So the faster you go, the sooner it'll be over. So ho, old girl!
Hmm.
No sooner had Tom finished speaking than the mare was away at a speed that Tom could neither check nor stop. His arms were nearly torn out of their sockets before the mare, of her own accord, suddenly stopped at a roadside inn that appeared almost out of the darkness.
Well, this is a rum-looking place you brought me to, and no mistake. Still, it looks comfortable enough. Hostler!
Sir?
You got accommodation here?
Yes, sir. We've always got accommodation, sir.
Good. See my horses are warm, bran mash, and as well littered down. I'll step up myself later to see you've done it.
Very good, sir.
In less than 5 minutes, Tom was ensconced before the fire in the bar parlour, with his feet on the fender. And in half an hour, he had partaken of a very nice little hot dinner, which the landlady, a buxom woman of about 48, had knocked up for him with her own hands. Now he was finishing it off with a second glass of hot rum punch, and altogether feeling very happy and contented.
I hope your dinner was to your liking, sir.
It was capital, Mum. My compliments. You keep a very good house here.
Thank you. I do my best. Though it's difficult for a woman to run a public on her own.
On your own? Are you a widow, ma'am, if you'll forgive the question?
These 2 years.
Must be lonely for you.
Sometimes. Is there anything more you'll be requiring?
I'll just take another glass of this hot rum punch, Mum, and then I'll be off to my bed.
I think you'll find your room comfortable, sir. Good night to you.
Good night to you, Mum, and thank you. Widow, with a nice little public. There's one thing I've always wanted, is to stand behind a bar of my own. Regular comfortable place, too. Neat servants, house and going order. Nothing to do but step in and marry Widow. Bless that little mare of mine for bringing me here.
Tom leaned back contentedly in his chair and happened to glance up at the mirror over the mantelpiece, which reflected a charming prospect of the bar with delightful rows of green bottles and gold labels, cheeses, boiled hams and rounds of beef, arranged on shelves in the most tempting and delicious way. What was not so delightful, however, was the reflection of a very tall man with black whiskers and black hair seated at tea with the widow and sitting uncommonly close to her.
Hello, hello. Looks like somebody's beat me to it. Damn it. Now he's kissing a hand. Such an ugly woolen, too. If you'd any taste, you're surely picking a better fellow than that. I've a good mind to go and punch his head for him.
I've brought your candle and your rum punch, sir. Would you like me to show you to your room now?
Might as well, my dear. Nothing to sit up for.
Tom's apartment was a good large room with a four-poster bed and a couple of presses that would have held the baggage of a small army. But what struck Tom's fancy most was a strange, grim-looking, high-backed chair, carved in the most fantastic manner, with a flowered damask cushion and the round knobs at the bottom of the legs carefully tied up in red cloth, as if it had got the gout in its toes.
Well, you're a curious object, I must say. I never seen such a rum concern in all my days. Odd. Very odd.
Still staring at the chair, Tom divested himself of his clothes, climbed into the four-poster bed, and fell asleep, but not for long. In about half an hour, Tom woke up with a start from a confused dream about tall men and tumblers of hot rum punch. And the first object he saw was the queer chair. And as he gazed at it, an extraordinary change came over it. The carving of the back gradually assumed the lineaments of an old, shriveled human face. The round knobs grew into a couple of feet encased in red cloth slippers. The damask cushion became an antique waistcoat. And the old chair looked like a very ugly old man of the previous century. Moreover, it was leering and winking at him in a most impudent manner.
What the devil are you winking at me for?
Because I like it, Tom Smart.
Well, I don't. How do you know my name, old nutcracker face?
Come, come, Tom. That's not the way to address polished Spanish mahogany. Dammy, you couldn't treat me with less respect if I was veneered.
I didn't mean to be disrespectful, sir.
Well, perhaps not, perhaps not. No doubt it would surprise you, Tom, to hear that I know everything about you.
You do?
For one thing, you're very poor. And for another, you're much too fond of rum punch.
Oh, well...
Now, don't deny it. And lastly, you'd very much like to marry the widow, wouldn't you, Tom?
How did you know
I that? Don't blame you. She's a remarkably fine woman. I'm her guardian, Tom.
You are?
I knew her mother and her grandmother. She was very fond of me. She made me this waistcoat. However, that's not the point. Tom, I want you to marry the widow.
Oh, it's no good, sir. There's someone else in the wind.
I know. Tall man with black whiskers. She'll never have him, Tom.
If you stood in the bar, you'd tell another story.
Rubbish! He's a rascally adventurer. The moment he married the widow, he'd sell all the furniture and run away. She'd be deserted, and I should catch my death of cold in some second-hand shop. Whereas you, Tom, if once you entered the public line, you'd never leave it so long as there was anything to drink left on the premises. Therefore, you shall have her, and the tall man shall not.
That's all very well, but what's to prevent it?
This. He's married already.
Married? But how can I prove it?
In that press, Tom, to the right of the bed, he's left a letter in a pair of trousers, a letter entreating him to return to his disconsolate wife with six babes, and all of them small ones. Show her that, Tom. Show her that.
As the old gentleman uttered these words, his features grew less and less distinct. The damask waistcoat resolved itself into a cushion, and the red slippers shrank into red cloth bags. Tom Smart fell back on his pillow and slept.
8 o'clock, sir!
What? Oh, thank you, my dear. Well... What a queer dream I had last night. Suppose it was a dream. Hey, how are you, old boy? I say you don't look like anything but a chair this morning. I wonder if there was anything in what you said. No harm in looking in that press, I suppose. Right hand one, you said. Well, here goes. Damn me if there ain't a pair of trousers here. And there's a letter in them. Blow me if it don't say exactly what he said it did. Oh, boy, if the rest of what you predicted comes true, I'll have you new upholstered, and you shall spend the rest of your days by the fire in the bar parlour. You shan't ever say Tom Smart weren't grateful.
Good morning, sir. I trust you slept well.
Excellently, thank you, ma'am. Never better.
And what will you take for breakfast, sir? There's a very nice ham and a beautiful cold larded fowl.
Mum.
Sir?
Who's that gentleman in the bar parlour?
Him? His name is Jenkins, sir.
Jenkins, eh? Mum, will you have the kindness to sit down a moment? Thank you. My dear ma'am, you deserve a very excellent husband. You do indeed. And whoever he is, you'll be a lucky man.
I'm sure I'm very much obliged to you, sir. And if ever I marry again...
It won't be Jenkins, ma'am. I know him.
I'm sure nobody who knows him knows anything bad about him.
Then I'll astonish you, ma'am. If I show you this letter, you promise you won't scream or go fainting away or any of that nonsense?
What's in that letter? Let me see it.
Here you are. And don't run out and blow him up, because I'll do that myself.
Oh, the deception, the villainy of man.
Frightful, ma'am, frightful.
I shall never find anyone I love so much.
Oh, yes, you will, my dear soul. He's here now, holding your precious hand, and willing to give his all for you.
Oh.
Tom Smart's his name, ma'am.
And here he stands.
And Jenkins?
Watch me, my dear, and open the front door.
Without a moment's delay, Tom Smart kicked the tall man out of doors and was married to the widow a month after. And he always said his greatest benefactors in life were his vixenish little mare and the old armchair.
It's a good story, Pickwick. Is it really supposed to be true?
Oh, Tom Smart always said so. He should know.
What became of the old armchair? Did Tom keep his promise to it?
He did. It stood by the fire in the bar parlour to the end of its days.
But it never spoke again.
It was observed to creak very much on the day of the wedding. No, it never spoke again.
And I doubt very much if our friend will speak again tonight. He's nearly asleep.
The dear, dear man. I could kiss him.
Miss Rachel. Shh. We leave him to his slumbers. Come.
The jovial party broke up next morning. And Mr. Pickwick and his friends once more took their seats on top of the Muggleton coach.
Wardle, my dear fellow, how can we thank you for such a Christmas?
Coming again next year.
It's a promise, my.
On aboard, gentlemen. Pickwick, Winkle, Tom.
We're all here, coachman.
Let go there, Ed.
Goodbye. 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 What a grand old fellow Wardle is.
What a woman Miss Rachel is.
And Miss Emily. And Miss Arabella Allen. What a perfectly delightful Christmas.
That was Christmas at Dingley Dell, adapted from the Pickwick Papers and Christmas Stories of Charles Dickens by Constance Cox. With Nigel Graham as our storyteller, Charles Dickens, and David March as Mr. Pickwick. Sam Weller was played by James Bryce, Mr. Tupman by John Gott, Mr. Winkle by Nicholas Courtney, Mr. Snodgrass by Jeffrey Edwards, Mr. Wardle by Michael Bilton, and Old Mrs. Wardle by Sheila Grant. Miss Rachel was played by Ellen McIntosh, Miss Emily by Eileen Tully, Miss Isabella by Helen Atkinson-Wood, Miss Arabella by Maggie McCarthy, Mr. George Trundle by Mark Rolston, and Emma by Carol Boyd. Stuart Organ was Joe the Fat Boy, Peter Wickham was Benjamin Allen, and Steve Hodson was Bob Sawyer. Characters in the two stories were played by members of the cast. The violinists were Ruth Ehrlich and Andrew Walton, the harpist Skylar Kanga, and the music was arranged by Chris Marshall. Christmas at Dingley Dell was directed by David Johnston.
Well, tomorrow afternoon we have another Christmas story, a true story. Have you ever wondered who good King Wenceslas really was? Well, tomorrow afternoon we take you back to the early 10th century, to the mountains and valleys of Bohemia. Wenceslas was king of Bohemia, a man with many friends and many enemies, but also a man of peace and vision.
Here, in the fire, is warmth. Here we have wine and bread. And here, for the moment, we have that peace within which can be nourished by these. This is all we need for life to be sustained in us, and God to give that life wonder. All the rest is greed and ambitious illusions. My desire is simply that every man, woman, and child within our little Bohemia should have that peace and the provision to enjoy these needs. And if the general achievement of this were to reduce me and my own household to the same peasant simplicity, I'd praise God for it.
David, Buck plays good King Wenceslas, and Mary Wimbush and Philip Sully also star in When the Snow Lay Round About, the true story of Wenceslas. Our play tomorrow afternoon at 2:30.